It's a real pleasure and privilege to stand here in such a succession of wise men and women speaking from this pulpit on these Lenten occasions. There's been much debate recently about the proper place of religion in society, and some insistent voices saying that religion should be a purely private affair, with no place in public life. So I welcome the title of this series, Religion in the Public Square, because it seems to me that if religious voices are silenced, then we allow our current market-based ideology unrestricted control over public life. As the late Tony Judd said in his book, Ill Fares the Land, humans need a language in which to express their moral instincts. And the market cannot provide that, because it's only concerned with the right to choose, and not with the call to serve or to sacrifice. So where do we begin in the tasks of religion and reconciliation? As was read to us earlier, Jesus said, I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, for if you love only those who love you, what reward do you have? And if you greet only your brothers and sisters, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. Here, it seems to me, is the mandate for the Christian task of reconciliation. Here is the mandate for interfaith dialogue. Here is the mandate for peacemaking. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. On that reckoning, Provost Dick Howard of Coventry was one of the outstanding children of God. In his determination in the hardest days of 1940, not to cry for vengeance against Germany for his ruined cathedral, but to call for forgiveness and reconciliation. In his Christmas Day broadcast to the nation, he spoke of a kinder, more Christ-childlike world. And so he set our cathedral on a course which continues to this day. The book which I had the privilege of editing, Reconciling People, tells its story. And I'd like to take one passage from that book as illustrative of what religious people can achieve when they follow what has been called their moral instincts. And it's just one striking account of how our own cathedral has played its part in the public square. One of the German centres of the cathedral's Community of the Cross of Nails is a village called Huchenfeld, just outside the city of Pforzheim. An East German Lutheran pastor retired there and began to unearth a story which the villagers did not want people to know. During a wartime raid on Pforzheim, a British plane was hit by anti-aircraft fire, its wing ablaze. The captain ordered his crew to bail out. His own parachute had jammed. He flew on expecting to die. But surprisingly, the fire went out, and he landed safely behind Allied lands. The nine who were bailed out came down near the village of Huchenfeld, on the edge of Pforzheim. Two were taken prisoner of war in quite an orderly way, but there was great anger at the devastation which the British bombing of Pforzheim had caused, and a local Nazi officer rounded up the remaining seven and locked them in the cellar of the village's town hall. The next morning, he put pistols into the hands of some of the Hitler youth, perhaps 15, 16-year-olds, and drove the airmen through a jeering crowd into the village churchyard. In the confusion, two managed to escape, but the other five were murdered. And this was the story that Pastor Heinemann Gruder heard about 40 years later. He determined not to let things rest until there had been a public acknowledgement of this lynching and a memorial placed to the victims. He faced a great deal of hostility, but he persevered. And knowing of Coventry Cathedral's work of reconciliation with Germany, he invited Canon Paul Oestreicher to the village to discuss all this with the mayor and others. But the village council was not willing to erect a memorial. Heinemann Gruder therefore persuaded the local church to act with a special service and a memorial on the church wall. Paul Oestreicher was invited to preach. The widow of one of the murdered men agreed to come. And at the Eucharist, one man who came forward to receive communion was crying bitterly. And Canon Paul quietly tried to comfort him. He said to Paul, "I'm so ashamed. I was one of the boys who killed them." He'd come for forgiveness almost 50 years later. After the service, Paul told Marjorie Taylor, the widow who'd come from England for the service, about him. Her immediate response was, "Find him. I'd love to put my arms around him and forgive him." They couldn't find him. But the story was published in several British papers, and on a sheep farm in North Wales, the surviving captain of the aircraft read the story. Until then, he'd never heard of the fate of his crew. He wrote to the mayor asking what he could do to express his gratitude to the village. A new kindergarten was being planned, and he agreed to come to its opening and brought as his gift a Welsh rocking horse. That led to the twinning of the villages of Hukenfelt and Llanbedr and an annual exchange visit of school children, which is still going on. In an RAF publication, the two who'd escaped also read the story, and they've become friends of Hukenfelt. Without Pastor Jürgen Heinemann Gruder and his stubborn insistence on penitence being seen to be done in the public square, there would be no story to tell. He died in November 2010, aged 90. The church was the instrument for that reconciliation, and perhaps only the church could have been in that situation. Now, reconciliation with Germany has long been a fact, although there are ominous noises from the tabloids and the football terraces whenever England plays Germany. But many would say that today it's religion, and Islam in particular, which is the real driver of conflict in the world. So at the risk of stealing some of Bishop Michael Nazarali's thunder later, I would like to talk a bit about Islam and reconciliation and my own encounter with Muslims. Let me remind you of Jesus' words. "If you greet only your brothers and sisters, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same?" Now, Muslims claim that their faith is all about peace, which may surprise those who haven't made a serious study of Islam. When one Muslim meets another, he will say, "Salam alaikum," which means "peace be with you." And the response is to return the greeting by simply reversing the words, "Wa alaikum assalam," and "on you be peace." And by peace is meant more than simply the absence of hostility between those who meet. It implies the prior submission of both parties to the Lord of the world. It assumes that those who exchange greetings in this way have made their peace with God. This God demands their loyalty above all other loyalties, and so sharing that ultimate loyalty, they know they can be at peace with one another. They've given their Islam, literally, their submission to God, and become Muslim. So they've received his salam, his peace. Islam, Muslim, salam. The words are all derived from the same root. That's the theology behind the greeting. And for most Muslims, it's probably just a convention, not a theology. But for those who do think about the words they use, one consequence can be that they will not offer this greeting to a non-Muslim such as a Christian. They suspect that he or she has not made that same Islam to God, that same submission. And they may say that Christians cannot submit to the one God because they worship three gods. Probably only a minority of Muslims take this view and maintain this distinction. But the fact that some do is sufficient for Christians, for some Christians, at least Christians in Pakistan, not to offer the full Muslim greeting, only a truncated version of it, in case they will be rejected by the Muslim who will refuse to return their greeting. I'm sure that such restricted greetings or non-greetings can be matched in other religious contexts. It's difficult to imagine the Pharisees of Jesus' time greeting Gentiles with the words Shalom Aleichem, the Hebrew equivalent of Salam Aleichem. Strong convictions tend to bring problems in relating to those who don't share them. Even mild Christians who have no intention of burning the Quran can feel a tad uneasy in meeting Muslims who are distinctively Muslim in dress and manner. More thoughtful believers will ask whether Christians and Muslims actually worship the same God. If they don't, then maybe the greeting and the meeting will be more guarded. It does seem that the more religion, the more problems. So it's acutely important that Jesus' words override these religious scruples. If you greet only your brothers and sisters, your own sort, your fellow believers, your co-religionists, we often need to be recalled to our common humanity. An earnest young Christian, very alert to the theological differences between Christianity and Islam, once asked me, "What do we say to the Muslims?" I said, "Try saying hello." In the early 1980s, I was invited to help a well-attended evangelical church in Manchester to develop relations with the local Muslim community there. Bangladeshi Muslims had adapted a building as a mosque only yards from the church. But there'd been no contact between the two congregations until I suggested a visit from the vicar and some leaders of the church. He and I met with the church leaders before going to the mosque, and it was very plain to me that they were anxious that they might be unable to explain their faith adequately to the Muslims. They were worried about discussing the Trinity and so on. When we crossed the road to the mosque, it was equally clear that the Bangladeshis had quite different anxieties. Racist graffiti was scrawled all over the mosque walls. The reinforced door concealed scorch marks from earlier attempts to firebomb the mosque through its letterbox. Here, Muslims were not worried about theological differences with Christians. They were happy to discuss these if we wanted to, but their real concern was whether Christians would help them to counter the racist hostility that they were experiencing on a daily basis. Now, that's now a long time ago, but in many ways, 9/11 and 7/7, as we've come to call them, the New York and London bombings, these have created much greater difficulties for British Muslims, something more akin to the suspicion which used to be around Irish people, that they might be members or sympathisers of the IRA. How can British Muslims distance themselves from terrorism in the public mind when the British media persist in highlighting the views and actions of the extremists? Statements put out by mainstream Muslim leadership rejecting terrorism are simply not reported. This is partly because there's no structure of Muslim leadership comparable to what we're familiar with in the churches. There's no equivalent to the Archbishop of Canterbury. There's no cardinal, no chief rabbi even. And yet, a year or so ago, I attended a big conference of some 300 or so young Muslim students at Warwick University. And I heard the internationally acclaimed speaker passionately rejecting the claim of Al-Qaeda and company to be acting in the name of Islam. "These people are not Muslims," he said. "They're criminals." And there was huge applause. What about a deeper understanding of Jesus' words, "If you greet only your brothers and sisters"? Jesus, I believe, was warning his hearers against what has been called Jewish exceptionalism, an attitude you find in the book of Numbers, for example, as the Israelites being a people living alone, not reckoning itself among the nations. Jesus opposes this attitude in any community which counts itself as peculiarly favored. He insists that we should love our enemies, pray for those who persecute us, that we may be children of our Father in heaven, for he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain, of course, a blessing in the Middle East, on the righteous and on the unrighteous. God is no respecter of persons. So our mandate for peacemaking and reconciliation springs from our understanding of God as creator and sustainer of all life. But the Christian distinctive is that we know God in Christ as Redeemer as well as Creator. God reconciled us to himself through Christ and has given us the ministry of reconciliation. God's revelation of himself in Christ is the final reality as we understand it, the ultimate truth, which we believe will be made evident to the whole of creation one day. That is what we believe and what we stand for. But meanwhile, we live not in the ultimate, but in the penultimate times. Too many religious people, Christians and Muslims and others, have behaved in the past as though they could take God's final judgment into their own hands and compel belief on their own terms. They wanted, some still want, a monopoly of the public square. The famous Baptist preacher of the 19th century, Charles Spurgeon, once addressed a huge Baptist audience, saying, "We Baptists have never persecuted anyone for their faith." There's great applause. "Because," he went on, "we've never been in a position to do so. Nothing offers greater ammunition to today's secularists than the attempt to compel belief, or at least submission to a particular set of beliefs. There's an interesting debate among scholars in the Muslim world today about the meaning of the verse in the Quran which says, La ikraha fi din, there should be no coercion in matters of faith. This is often quoted by Muslims with pride, but it's clear from commentators on the Quran that it only applies to those who are outside Islam, those who must not be forced to become Muslims. You are free to become a Muslim or remain as you are. So conversion by force is utterly un-Islamic. But if you are already a Muslim, you are not free to become something else. The verse does not mean, as generally understood, that you are free to leave Islam. How could there be freedom, some would say, to choose the worse rather than the better? You cannot compel faith. Now, I don't say this to denigrate Islam and Muslims, but to show how deep-rooted is the desire in many parts of the world, and here in Europe in the past, to maintain a coherent, outwardly conforming society, even at the cost of inner personal dissent. You had very similar arguments used in the Western Latin-speaking church from the great Augustine of Hippo in the 5th century onwards. Augustine has been called the first theorist of the Inquisition. And if you've seen the RSC production Written on the Heart, you don't need to be reminded of what horrors religious conviction could instigate in the 16th and 17th centuries. Even in the early 20th century, the Roman Catholic Church was saying that error has no rights. Every person has, of course, its own understanding of ultimate things, the non-negotiable bottom line of faith, the belief which must never be compromised or threatened. For Muslims, that will be the message of the Quran as delivered through the prophethood of Muhammad. We saw how deeply Muslims venerate the person of Muhammad in the uproar surrounding the publication of Salman Rushdie's book, The Satanic Verses, and more recently in the cartoons of Danish artists in the magazine Elands Posten. For many Muslims, it was intolerable that the prophet of Islam should be mocked and misrepresented, made a figure of fun. As some understand it, these offences threatened their very salvation, since in the Day of Judgment, the prophet of Islam is expected by many to speak to God on behalf of his community. But why should he do so if his community fails to speak for him when his reputation is attacked and defamed? Christians need not feel superior to such anxieties. Did not Jesus say, "Those who are ashamed of me and of my words, of them the Son of Man will be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and the holy angels"? The convictions are different, but the sentiment and the anxiety is the same. Somehow we have to live together, respecting these ultimate, non-negotiable convictions and the people who hold them. We know these people to be infinitely precious to God, although we don't believe as they do. People ask, how can you respect beliefs you don't share, actually believed to be mistaken? I suppose there are three possible ways of dealing with beliefs we don't share. One is a variety of agnosticism. How can we know the truth about these things? It goes, God, if there is a God, is beyond definition. all religious people do is to pile up words without any foundation in verifiable evidence. There are more sophisticated forms of the argument, but at heart this attitude dismisses religious language as essentially meaningless. This is the approach which I believe lies behind the attempt to exclude religion from public life. The second attitude is on the face of it more positive, but it wants to corral all religious conviction into one basic philosophy. All religions stand for the same things, it says. They're all different ways up the same mountain. Again, there are crude and sophisticated versions of this argument. It's true that there are overlapping ethical traditions between the great faiths, but I find it impossible to agree that the non-theist philosophies of Buddhism and some forms of Hinduism have very much in common with the burning desire of an Isaiah, St. Paul, or Muhammad to serve the God who spoke to them in person. The only approach which takes other faiths seriously is the one which acknowledges the deep divisions and contradictions between them, but recognizes a common sense of overwhelming obligation and answering commitment among the believers of each faith. This is what we respect, because that approach offers a recognition of the proper distinctiveness of the faiths. This is something which is in danger of being lost in the often ham-fisted policies of governments, local and national, towards religious issues. The problem is that the attempt to make no distinction between the faiths risks robbing all of them of any distinctiveness, consigning all of them to a rubbish bin marked bowing and chanting. Some would be only too pleased to do that. And you can't avoid the suspicion that in this country, attacks on Christianity and its privileges in the name of sensitivity towards other faiths are really attacks on all religion. Christianity is simply an easier target than Islam or Judaism. But attacks on Christianity are not supported by those of other religious traditions. It was a Sikh, Lord Inderjeet Singh, who last month in the BBC's Thought for the Day regretted the judicial decision that, as he understood it, local councils were judged to have no legal right to hold prayers at the beginnings of their meetings. Similarly, the present and previous chief rabbis have both spoken in favour of the establishment of the Church of England, as did the distinguished Muslim leader Zaki Badawi. It's Baroness Varsi, the first Muslim woman to be a member of a British cabinet, who said recently, "Why would you try to erase our religious history or the role of Christianity in the development of the values of our nations? Europe needs to be more in tune with its Christian identity," said this Muslim woman. Now, these things could not have been said if, as people sometimes assume, religions were always at each other's throats. Whatever happened further in the past, religious reconciliation has a long history in this country. Marcus Braybrook gave us some of the story from this pulpit last week. Our own Coventry Cathedral has long been in the business not only of international but of interfaith reconciliation. In the 1960s, Canon Peter Berry began work as one of the earliest appointments in the Church of England for what was then called community relations. His name is still honoured among Sikhs and Hindus and Muslims in Coventry for his friendship and his advocacy of their needs when they were settling into this country. I succeeded to his legacy in the 1980s, and all the time the international reconciliation work of the cathedral was developing in interfaith directions. Canon Andrew White, as you all know, continues a heroic ministry in Baghdad. Earlier, when he was still at the cathedral, he was hugely instrumental in bringing about the Alexandria Declaration, signed by archbishops, chief rabbis, and leading Muslim clerics of the Middle East. Justin Welby, now Bishop of Durham, was equally active in helping to bring together warring Muslim and Christian groups in northern Nigeria. All this was done under the banner of the cathedral in its particular vocation of reconciliation. Reconciliation means remembering our common humanity under God. As Psalm 39 says, we are all the guests of God in his world. Reconciliation means obedience to the 9th commandment, that we do not bear false witness against our neighbor by misrepresenting his or her faith, maybe comparing our ideals with his practice. Reconciliation means going the extra mile to care for those whom we could identify as enemies and to greet them with the peace of God. Reconciliation means knowing ourselves to be entrusted with the ministry of reconciliation, so that we do not advertise ourselves, but as Jesus Christ as Lord, and as ourselves servants for his sake. So let us not lose our nerve for being used as reconcilers in the public square. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God.